This is the Reason Podcast with Nick Gillespie. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast by going to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or to reason.com/podcasts. Please subscribe. In the wake of the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, protests have erupted around the country. Some of these have turned violent and resulted in injuries to citizens and police, as well as spurring looting and property damage. Cities have implemented curfews and other restrictions on movement, further stoking tensions that were already high due to the coronavirus lockdown, the start of summer, and a 15% unemployment rate. The last time the nation faced this level of social unrest was 1968, the year that Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated. The last time the nation faced this level of social unrest was 1968, the year that Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated. To help me make sense of the current moment and figure out where it might lead, I spoke with Omar Wasso, a political scientist at Princeton, who has studied how protests of the 1960s affected public opinion, social discourse, and voting patterns. Will today's protests make policing reform more or less likely? Is it possible that the violence in the streets we're seeing now will boost Donald Trump's re-election chances, just as events in 1968 helped to put Richard Nixon in the White House? Wasso's research also looks at the nature of police misconduct. He's analyzed whether headline-grabbing incidents such as the horrific killings of Eric Garner and Tamir Rice are the result of a few bad apples or a systemic problem with law enforcement in minority communities. We talk about all that and more in the Reason interview with Omar Wasso. Omar Wasso, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you for having me.
Can you outline your findings about protest violence and political outcomes?
Sure. So the big picture is that a lot of research suggested that protests should have little to no effect in politics. A bunch of people go out on the street, they make some noise, you know, it doesn't matter. Elites dominate politics. And what I found, consistent with some other research on protests, is that in fact protests are influential. And my work in particular finds that protests are influential through the effect they have on media. And so protests shape what the media talk about, and what the media talk about in turn influences public opinion. And that then shapes what people in Congress are doing, or what kind of legislation gets passed, or in fact, as you mentioned, who might win a presidency.
Let's get to the presidential election in, you know, I mean, or down the road. And obviously this is wild speculation of the type that academics never want to indulge in, but I'm going to force you to. But you were looking at the period between 1960 to 1972. And before we get into what you found there, is there a difference in the way media, you know, media back then is very different than media now? Do you worry at all about the relevance of your research, not for explaining what happened, but what might be going on now?
It's a really good question. And I think there are some really important differences and also some important similarities. So why don't I go through some of the differences first? So clearly, there are way more media now than there were in the past. And not just that, but it's much more fragmented, right? So every one of us has our own distinct social media feed that is going to be unique and give us a different vantage point on the same event, let alone hundreds of events around the country. We also have a kind of intimacy that comes from people's cell phone footage. And so where the power of a single image in the 1960s that was conveyed on a newspaper might have brought you there to a degree, I still don't think that's as powerful as sitting watching George Floyd be killed before your own eyes. I mean, the sort of the anger and rage and grief that that triggers when you see a man crying for his mother as he's, you know, as a cop has his knee in his neck. Like that's a kind of visceral, intimate, powerful, terrifying, direct experience of media that was only partly conveyed in the past.
Right, because even when we were able to see very stark images, dogs being set loose on protesters and things like that, oftentimes it was either a still image or we didn't see it at all because the networks weren't really showing that kind of brutality.
Yeah, I mean, one, just given that we have a little bit of extra time to kind of go into some of these details, one of the remarkable things about Bloody Sunday is that there is a national documentary about the Nuremberg trials that's playing on television. And they cut into, you know, sort of a story about Nazi war crimes to footage in Selma of people like Representative John Lewis being beaten brutally by police and vigilantes.
Yeah.
And so that contrast in that moment was exceedingly powerful. And there's good evidence that it really did shock the conscience of the nation and for a lot of people made them realize that, you know, what's going on in the South is not normal politics. This is unacceptable. And I think there are moments that are in the past that are that visceral. But I think what's different now is the way in which there are things that Black people have been saying for a long time. Police engage in abusive behavior in our communities. And now people can see it for themselves in a way that really maybe began with the video of the beating of Rodney King, but has become much more part of our common lived experience. And I suspect has played a role in making particularly white liberals more attuned to Black concerns about racial equality. One similarity, though, I think between the 1960s and now is that the media tend to rely on some fairly common scripts or narratives for how stories get told. And one of those is a kind of a right script or a, you know, a kind of a justice narrative. And another is more of a crime script. And what we saw in the 60s was that nonviolent protests, particularly nonviolent protests met with state repression, with vigilante violence, were much more likely to be presented as a kind of redress of grievances, as a demonstration, as a march, as a call for civil rights. So a nonviolent protest today produced a headline about civil rights tomorrow. Whereas when protesters engaged in violence, that predicted a headline about riots tomorrow, a headline that was much more likely to focus on crime and disorder. And public opinion moves very closely with that. So when the newspapers are talking about civil rights becomes the most important problem in public opinion surveys. And when newspapers are heavily covering crime and riots become the thing that is the most important problem. And so the tactics that are employed by protesters can really make a powerful impact on how the media tell the story, which in turn shapes public opinion. And I think that's still likely to be quite true today.
In the 60s, and especially coming out of the civil rights movement, it seems as if, and this might be an artifact both of my not understanding it fully, but also looking backwards, that civil rights marches were kind of scripted. They were organized. The people who participated in them were taught passive resistance and kind of like don't fight back, et cetera. Today's protests all over the country seem to be much less organized. Does that factor into this at all? Or, you know, did the, I guess, in a way, did the 60s protesters know what they were doing in a way that it doesn't necessarily seem clear that what's going on today is under anybody's control?
I think that's right, that there's a, a lot of the protests in the 60s that escalated to violence started out as organized, nonviolent, civil disobedience. But when people are, you know, enraged about, you know, a police killing or some aspect of state violence, it's just, it can be very hard to sustain that level of kind of order and focus, particularly if the nonviolent protests, which were successful, in part employed producing lots and lots of images of state violence, of police right. killings. And so once people are kind of seeing that imagery and getting angry, it becomes much harder to kind of, I think, to do that very disciplined, you know, as you said, passive resistance that took training, that takes incredible, you know, perseverance to sort of let somebody hit you and not hit back.
Right.
But there's another dimension to what you're saying, which is, I think, even more true today, which is that part of what's powerful about cell phones and, you know, the internet and these sort of, and, you know, just a variety of communications technologies is it makes the transaction costs for coordinating a large scale gathering much, much lower than they would have been in the 60s. And so it's now possible for, you know, somebody via Twitter or Facebook to kind of say, we're meeting at this location, and that solves the coordination problem. And suddenly, in a very spontaneous and not coordinated in the, you know, we trained, we knew what we were getting into sort of way, that makes it possible for there to be this kind of explosion of activity that lacks a center and any kind of coherent agenda or organizer. Now, of course, there are organizers involved in these events, and there are organizers who have a long history doing work, but they're just sort of one constituency in this, you know, kind of explosion of activity. And to be clear, most of these protests have been peaceful, but there are many constituencies, and you're exactly right. It's much less centrally organized.
One of the kind of disturbing discoveries of your research is really that the best outcomes from a kind of civil rights perspective were when protesters were nonviolent and the state police, law enforcement were violent. Is that accurate? And why do you think that helps push civil rights forward?
Yeah, that's a good summary. And let me step back and sort of set up one part of why that, the logic of that. And so initially, nonviolent protesters in the South were getting attention, but as one reporter said, of a very large protest in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, if there's, you know, no conflict, if there's no violence, this is a boring story. You know, what I want is blood and guts. That's what makes a story. Mm-hmm. And what the leaders of the nonviolent civil rights movement figured out was that what really generated national press was when there was state repression that was, excessive. And that partly was useful because it got the press's attention and generated national media. It also was really important because a lot of white moderates who might have, you know, had some awareness of a sense of, you know, racial, you know, that Jim Crow was this kind of, that blacks were second class citizens in the South, but it didn't move them politically. They could view a nonviolent protest as something that was normal politics. Look, the system's working. And it was only when there was an excess of state repression, when there was this kind of brutal, you know, as you mentioned, sticking dogs on young people, fire hoses on young people. In that context, it's very hard for the kind of disengaged or maybe even hostile white moderate outside of the country to say, hey, it's working okay. The system is, it's normal politics. So the strategic use of violence where protesters were the object of violence, both shocked the conscience of the country into saying, okay, wait, that's a little beyond what we're comfortable with,
right?
And got the media to become, very engaged.
What was the role, and I'm thinking of Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail where, you know, that's addressed to white moderates who are saying, you know, you got to wait, the system is working. And he gestures towards, if you don't deal with me, with a peaceful person who's willing to work through the system but is going to push the issue, you're going to have to deal with violent elements in the kind of Black civil rights movement, the Black Panthers or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Council or Committee. Is that kind of dynamic at play here, do you think? Because, is there a sense that we as a country, we need to deal with this peacefully? Otherwise, there is a set of groups, whether it's Antifa or something else, that's going to cause many more problems.
Yeah. So I think the that's sometimes called like a radical flank hypothesis. The idea is if there's a kind of a threatening, more extreme group, that makes the moderates more attractive to negotiate with. And I think broadly that's plausible. And I don't think there's any reason to doubt that kind of those dynamics are at play in any kind of negotiation. In the early part of the 1960s, certainly Malcolm X is a presence, but the Black Power movement, the Black Panthers, haven't really come onto the scene when the 1964 Civil Rights Act is passed, when the 65 Voting Rights Act is passed. And the big wave of violent protest activity comes after 65, right? So really the biggest high-profile violent protest is in Watts, and that comes just after the Voting Rights Act. So I think it's very reasonable to say that, in fact, the threat of violent resistance, while certainly always a part of, I think, white leaders' consciousness, is not the thing that's driving the passage of the Voting Rights Act or the Civil Rights Act. I think it's much, what I see in my public opinion data is the more people who are engaging in nonviolent protest, the more public opinion changes, and both with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, within a year, those laws get enacted. And so moving public opinion, growing the coalition of people in favor of those changes, moved politics. In the later period, there is some evidence that violence did, in fact, produce certain kinds of benefits for Black communities. But I also find, in addition to those benefits, that violence probably contributed to a growing of the law and order coalition that really was pushing for more repressive policies, too.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about 1968? In the article that you wrote, that comes up, and you basically say that because of violent behavior by protesters or fear of that by white voters, they tipped into the Republican camp. Richard, it's kind of hard to, I guess, recover this history, at least in a common sense. But Nixon, it was a three-way race with Nixon, Humphrey, and George Wallace, who was an explicit segregationist. Nixon got in with a plurality of votes, not a majority by any stretch. How did, what were the events that made people, made whites scared that they ended up going into the Republican camp and letting Nixon eke out a victory?
Yeah, so I think just to put this, you've framed it all really well, and I just want to take one step even further back and say, let's start with Goldwater, who ran on Law and Order and lost badly. And so there's a puzzle from that sort of was one of the things that motivated my research, which really begins with where did Law and Order come from? How did mass incarceration become, what is it about what happened in the late 60s and 70s that kind of seemed to lay the groundwork for this hockey stick increase in incarceration in this country? And the puzzle is, why did Law and Order fail for Goldwater but work for Nixon? Mm-hmm. And there's even one more dimension to that. Ronald Reagan runs on Law and Order for the governorship of California in 1966. And he wins, substantially. Right. And so Law and Order isn't working in 64. It is working in 66. It is working in 68. Why is that?
And if, can I complicate or throw in another log on the fire here, kind of, which is that Nixon did pretty well among African Americans in 1960 when he was running against Kennedy. I mean, he was, what did he get, like 25-30% or something like that? I mean, it was substantially higher than any Republican has gotten since.
Yeah. Well, so that's a really important point. And let me kind of try to braid it together with kind of two ideas, right? So one is that, why does Reagan beat the incumbent Pat Brown, who had been quite popular? There's evidence in my research and others that there's a strong shift among a certain subset of Democrats away from the Democratic Party following the Watts uprising in 1965, right? So Law and Order becomes a winning strategy following Watts. And then in 67 and 68, there are very large violent protests. And to be clear, while what we're seeing now is quite dramatic compared to what was happening in the 60s, these are still relatively modest events. I don't want to minimize any particular injury, death, building going up in flames. But in Watts, there were something like 3,000 incidents of arson. So just a totally different scale of unrest. And so that sort of pushes these issues, and again, the media is covering this. There's this very dramatic footage. And that means that what we see in public opinion is that that issues of crime and riots are moving up in the summer, down in the winter, up in the summer, down in the winter, as we build up to 1968. And so the public opinion data looks very consistent with the story about the public is responding to what's happening on the ground, that violent protest is driving a concern about crime and riots are the most important problem in America. And the other issue that you brought up, which is a really important one, is basically in 1964, the Democrats, in 1960, it's not clear which party is the party of African-American interest.
Right.
The Republican Party is actually more liberal than the Democratic Party on a civil rights bill that's introduced before 64. But basically with 64, with Johnson kind of leading the charge on the party side and the pressure from activists with things like the March on Washington in 63, the Democrats become the party of civil rights. The Democrats split from the Southern Democratic wing, which was segregationist, and becomes the party aligned with African-American interests. And in that shift, suddenly Nixon, who might have been more progressive on race, has a, there's a kind of realignment of the parties where one is the party of Black interests and one is the party, essentially over time becomes the party of a certain class of white interests. And that means that Law and Order, which is not explicitly racial, but it's kind of coded language that translates as you know, I'm going to keep those outgroups in control. And so the combination of the Civil Rights Act and the, you know, unrest on the ground sort of produces this competition over race in our party system. And the Democratic Party is, you know, the Republicans really own the issue of law and order then for the next 50 or 60 years.
You know, kind of flash forwarding to contemporary America, Donald Trump in 2016 ran as a law and order candidate. I mean, he used that phrase, harkening back at least to Nixon. In the current context, I mean, it seems like Trump is very much, you know, he's anti-protest, and he equates any kind of protest with rioting and that type of thing. Does that mean, you know, and then you have Joe Biden, who weirdly, you know, has been part of the American political establishment for 50 years, played big roles in things like ramping up the drug war, crime bills that put a lot of black people in particular in jail. He's walked back some of his what used to be his legislative accomplishments. Is there a clear sense of where any of this goes in the 2020 election?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I think there are a couple of things that are predictable and a bunch of things that are super unpredictable. And in the kind of predictable scenario, right, we know, we've just seen Trump will almost always play to his base and has very little interest in trying to, you know, bridge divides. You know, his just first instinct consistently is to kind of turn up the volume on division. Right. And we're seeing that right now. And I think,
although it's also bizarre in a way that he did better with African-Americans and Latinos than either Mitt Romney or John McCain. So it, you know, I mean, he's still below double digits.
Yeah. But I mean, he might have done 9% with African-Americans.
Yeah. Instead of like 7 or something. Yeah.
And I think
yeah.
to be clear, there's a certain kind of, in particular, man who appreciates a kind of macho candidate. And that has a lot of appeal. These sort of, there's some evidence that we've seen a kind of sorting of the parties on a taste for what in political science is called authoritarianism, but you can think of as sort of a more traditional social order, more patriarchal, more there's sort of a black and white view of the world.
Right.
And so if you're an African American who has those kind of authoritarian tendencies, Trump may be very appealing. But that's still a very small percentage overall. But you're right. It's a higher number among Latinos. And I think the big picture though is that Trump is, you know, has already run on law and order. It, depending on how the next few weeks and summer play out, it may or may not continue to be really salient come November. Right. But if it does, it's almost certain that that's going to be a core part of his message, because his entire campaign, going back to his first address, was, you know, there are these criminal elements, you know, maybe they're Mexican, but later they're, you know, blacks in cities. I alone can fix it. Right. And so he's the strong man. And so I think that's, you know, that's a fairly, it doesn't take a lot of research to say that's a conservative, you know, safe prediction.
Yeah.
But what I think is unpredictable is he's the incumbent. And in some cases, it might mean that he is associated with the disorder. And so there may be people who, you know, like some of what he has to offer, but feel like he's actually more of a chaos agent than a source of stability. And the key thing that I see in my research that I think is still at play today is in the earlier era, and I think this is hard for people to really wrap their heads around, there are people who are open to racial equality, right? Like Johnson wins in a landslide in 1964, and there's a lot going on there. There's Kennedy's assassination, but the Civil Rights Bill has passed. And there's a Democratic coalition of white moderates and white liberals and African Americans that holds, right? So this, it's not just the 64 Civil Rights Act that splinters the Democratic coalition. And I think that there's, so the key idea is there are white moderates who are, you know, they don't prioritize racial equality, but they're not opposed to it necessarily, but they do care about order. And so they're kind of adjudicating between a party that they might like some things about and has racial equality as a core plank, and a party that says, I'm going to really fight for order. And those white moderates can really play a critical role in tipping an election. And I find that, you know, it's mid-Atlantic states and Midwestern states that are the ones that potentially tip in 1968. that's quite similar to what happened in 2016, where the states in play, you know, are Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan. And so I think it's likely that in 2020, even though whites on average are much more concerned about racial equality, that there are going to be these swing voters who, you know, are sympathetic to Black concerns and care about order and are going to be pulled between Biden and Trump. And the kinds of narratives that come out of these protest movements, the kind of narratives that come from the two candidates are really going to help those folks align with one camp or another. And I don't know quite how that's going to play out.
Yeah, and it's interesting to realize, too, that the first big explosion of this round of protests come out of Minneapolis, which is a Midwestern state, but and reliably Democratic and kind of liberal, but then also kind of Midwestern conservative. Places like Louisville, Kentucky, which is kind of the South, but not really, really heartland. Can I ask, this is a kind of orthogonal, I guess, to this question of, you know, when we look at 1968 versus now, and I would say, and correct me if you disagree with this, in most ways, the country is unrecognizable in terms of race relations, in terms of equality, not just for African-Americans, but for women. Sexual orientation is not an issue. It was unspeakable in 1968. It's less and less of an issue, if it's one at all, today. How do we talk about progress along racial lines that is incomplete or is still problematic? Because one of the things that was kind of remarkable about this, the event with George Floyd, or the killing of him, even versus Ferguson, is that nobody was really defending the police actions here. You really search, even people like Trump are not saying that he deserved to die or he caused his death. Everybody is saying this is wrong. How do we account for that without, you know, saying, okay, so we really don't have to do reform?
So it's a really good question. And I think the way I think about this is a kind of Tale of Two Cities story, that following the breaking of Jim Crow, a really remarkable act of insurgency by African Americans to overturn an oppressive regime. Following that that movement, we have both enormous progress for African Americans in particular, and for, call it the bottom, 40% of African Americans.
Right.
A terrible, and in some cases even worse, situation. And so we have to be able to hold that kind of dual path at the same time. And so on the progress side, you've got an enormous opening up of opportunity, educational, employment, housing. I mean, just a real flourishing of the Black middle class in a way that is really important to recognize and to appreciate and reflects absolutely progress in America. And at the same time, and this is part of what took me back to school, and when we're talking about issues of mass incarceration and criminal justice, right? We have the rise of the war on drugs. We have this massive hockey stick increase in incarceration and all sorts of other kinds of really devastating social and economic effects in the Black community in particular. So, employment opportunities as part of deindustrialization become much tougher, and there are any number of other sorts of, sort of kinds of social dislocation that are happening, particularly for that bottom 40%. And I think part of what is so important about what happened with George Floyd, and to be clear, again, exactly as you said it, the police killing of George Floyd, is that it really focuses our attention on one of the core issues that has been a source of trauma over the last half century, which is that criminal justice has been just a profoundly unequal and a profoundly brutal system for African Americans. And that is affecting the bottom 40% much more than for African Americans, the top 50%. I'm not saying that there aren't lots of folks, my former advisor, Henry Louis Gates, getting, arrested in his own home. I'm not saying those things don't happen, but it's way more devastating for the people who get kind of trapped in a criminal justice system that just does not let people go and kind of constrains all of their life chances.
Right.
And so that's how I think of the has there been progress? Enormous progress, particularly on the things you're talking about, the kind of social liberalism stuff. but on a bunch of material well-being, and in particular in kind of terms of liberty, right, the number of people who are locked in cages, we have not made progress.
And I that was part of, I think, what came out of the Ferguson moment there, of recognizing how many levels of kind of social control through fines and other types of policing, which definitely just, disproportionately affected and screwed over Black communities. That was invisible to a lot of people.
Yeah, that's right. And so there was a kind of essentially taxation through fees. So, right. the state was funding its activities by, petty fines that would accrue and could be devastating. And I mean, I just think when I was reading about that moment, I was thinking about a ticket I got for speeding. Yeah. And I was going the same speed as everybody else. I got, it was the end of the month. It was clear they had a quota. Right. I got picked. And I was so angry, I didn't pay it for, another, whatever it was. I missed the deadline two times. Yeah. And I was screwing myself over, but I was so angry about the fee and the feeling of, this wrongful kind of ticket that, my way of protesting was in some ways to screw myself over by not paying it.
But you could pay it. I mean, and then that's the type of thing where, it becomes a never ending sinkhole for people who don't have who can't pay it, right?
That's right. And I'm coming to that with great privilege. So I ultimately paid it. My life is fine.
Right.
But imagine if you couldn't pay it, or imagine if there's this kind of devastating accrual of all sorts of, your grass isn't cut at the right height kind of stuff, that can be really maddening. And then you throw into that an unjust, what people perceive to be an unjust killing. And it's just, it's a kind of tinder. And you're right that was invisible. And I think it's important on the progress side to note that as much as people might think the Black Lives Matter movement kind of petered out as Trump gained power or came to office, we've seen at the local level reform DAs in cities across the country win. There have been changes in use of force policies that have had material benefits for reducing the amount of police abuse that we observe. Right. And so I think that's also less visible, but there really has been a reform movement that has made progress.
Yeah.
And I suspect that even Trump is kind of operating in some ways in a new set of constraints where he might, say Blue Lives Matter, not Black Lives Matter, but he doesn't want to align himself with the guy who, kills a man crying for his mother on camera.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, he signed the First Step Act. He's made certain gestures towards criminal justice reform, which are actually historic. So, and when you go back to at the more local or state level, certain types of asset forfeiture laws have been changed, and cash bail is being repealed in places, which are all, very positive developments. Let's talk a little bit about policing, or a reform of policing, because that is kind of front and center. One of the things that, some of the protests, and I'm in New York City. I was along a protest yesterday that very quickly went from talking about George Floyd and other recent cases of violent death at the hands of law enforcement to, attacking capitalism writ large and all sorts of other types of things. But to go back to this primary issue of police reform, you've written on Twitter, you've talked about how people, when they talk about reform, they tend to either say we need a complete systemic reform, or we just need to pull the bad apples out. And you've stressed that, in fact, it's both, and that, getting rid of bad apples is recognizing who the bad players are in a system is a lot easier than we seem to believe. Could you talk a little bit about what's going on there and what your analysis shows?
Yeah, this was really striking to me when I started looking into this a few years ago. So, the bad apples rhetoric says, most cops are okay. We just have some rogue actors, right? And the sort of system story says, no, the whole thing is corrupt and you kind of need to—
All cops are bad.
And what was sort of surprising to me when I looked at some of the data is how disproportionate it is in terms of a very small percentage of cops generate a way disproportionate percentage of the civilian complaints. So in a place like Chicago, it was something like 1% of cops generate 25% of the civilian complaints. In New York, there were cops who had, 20, 30, 50 civilian complaints who were still out on the street. And if you look at the pattern, the cop who shoots Laquan McDonald in Chicago had something like 17 complaints against him. The guy who chokeholds Eric Garner, and you know, as he's screaming, "I can't breathe," had I think it was like 12 complaints against him. There are, and the person who killed George Floyd had a pattern of abuse.
Right.
And so, if you are thinking about this, you know, the bad apples versus systems question, what became very clear to me is, in fact, the modal police officer. I think in New York, it was something like 40% have zero complaints against them, right? So in fact, there are a lot of cops, and whether you are pro or anti-cop, or that's even the wrong frame, like, it's clear that there are some cops who are doing way more harm than others, and getting those cops off the street would do a lot of good, right? Eric Garner might be alive.
What are the obstacles? What are the obstacles to, you know, when you have such a small percentage of cops causing so many of the complaints? You know, what are the obstacles to pulling them out of the system?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this speaks to the need to kind of focus on both systems and individuals, right? And that clearly there's a systemic failure, which is the, you know, like, these cops engaged in repeated abuse aren't being sanctioned in any sufficient way, fired, you know, put on a desk job, demoted in some way that sends a signal to everyone else. That's off bounds, right? And so that's the systemic part of the failure.
Is that a union thing? Is that a solidarity, like a thin blue line type of thing? Do you have a sense of what's causing that?
I think part of what's remarkable about this issue is this is actually terrible for cops, right? Having a cop who knees a man to death on his neck is terrible for cops. And if you were a kind of rational police union, you would be interested in getting the rogue actors out of out of your profession. And I think in a lot of contexts, it's a thin blue line. It's a kind of, you know, a level of solidarity that defends almost every kind of action by police. And in fact, if the police unions, if the police, the mayors and governors who oversee these institutions, if they were much tougher on that 1-2%, we could potentially be reducing the level of abuse, 25%, right? And that really matters. Another example of this that's kind of, getting that worst officer out, Tamir Rice, right? A child playing with a toy gun, shot by a cop, who had been fired by another police station, police force, because he was deemed as unfit, and then hired by the force that ultimately, in which he shot Tamir Rice, right? And again and again, the people engaging in these kind of egregious abuse have this pattern. And the other thing, I think, coming back to your question about why doesn't it change, is I think in some ways, focusing on the system change is really hard. That's like a big kind of pot to boil. And part of what I was arguing in one piece I wrote for The Root is that it's, part of what you want as a movement is cases that put the opposition on their heels, right? And so a cop in New York who has 51 complaints against him, that's really hard to defend. And that's a really good place to be if you're trying to push for reform and accountability for police. And so my argument was partly, there's a material benefit, right? You might have fewer of these kinds of abuses, but it's also rhetorically very powerful to focus on these extreme cases that, while maybe only 1%, still matter enormously in terms of the quality of life for Black communities.
Final question. How do you feel, about the next 3, 4, 5, 6 months? We have the COVID lockdown, we have massive unemployment, we have, hot weather, warm weather, good weather coming out, and now one of the most intense convulsions of a number of overlapping issues, that are causing real disruption and ferment. What are you thinking? Are we going to get through this, or is it going to get a lot worse?
So let me enter in kind of a couple of parts. So I think the pessimistic part of me says, I don't have much optimism that there's going to be any kind of rapid change on criminal justice issues. I think that's a long, slow fight that for which there is real progress, decriminalization of marijuana, you know, these DAs getting elected. There is real progress on criminal justice issues, but the apparatus is so vast that it's going to take a long time to try and make headway on that. And so I fear for our country, in as much as there will be more of these horrible police killing of unarmed Black people caught on camera for years to come. And that's a terrible thing. And I wish I had more optimism about that. But on a more encouraging note, I think in the 60s, there was a sense of the whole social fabric was coming undone. So we had Martin Luther King assassinated, two Kennedys assassinated. The world was just, you know, a level of social unrest. Yes, what happened this past weekend was dramatic, but again, in the 60s, you're talking about, you know, thousands of instances of arson in a place like Detroit. The National Guard comes in, shoots 15,000 rounds of ammunition, 34 people die. I mean, it's a level of like low grade civil unrest that looks like a civil war or something kind of akin to that. And this is not at all at that level, at least at this stage. And so I also feel like there's some reason to think that we're moving through this in a way that's likely to not kind of tear the fabric entirely. But I think the really big question that's not specifically about Trump or the unrest is that our kind of our democratic institutions are in some ways being challenged. And so, you know, can we maintain a kind of core commitment to both things like, you know, civil rights and civil liberties and, you know, voting and voting rights. And I worry about democratic erosion in this country. So I was trying to find the optimistic note.
Yeah, I was going to say
that was not it. I guess it's a more peaceful period. And I think that stability is good for, you know, kind of for progress. Yeah.
Well, it's odd because, you know, when Trump gave his inaugural speech where he was talking about American carnage, and he was describing an America, you know, that was bleeding, you know, from street crime that maybe existed in the 70s, but certainly wasn't anything common. But by the same token, when you go back to the late 60s, the amounts of trust and confidence in the government and other institutions of authority was much, much higher than it is now. So it's kind of, you know, where, you know, there's much less crime, but there's also much less confidence. I don't know where that leads.
Well, I think, you know, we are at the frontier of a challenge that I don't think has been fully appreciated, which is that, and it goes back to your point about, you know, between 60 and 64, what changes. We're trying to build a multiracial democracy, and that turns out to be an exceedingly difficult thing. And that a bunch of countries that have multi-ethnic states converge to not really being democracies. They kind of become ethno-nationalist authoritarian states. There are examples like Canada that kind of embrace being multi-ethnic states. Right. And I think we're in the middle of this convulsion where part of Trump's appeal is he's saying, no, I'm going to reassert the old social order, right? Make America great again with whites and Christians on top. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of counter-mobilization, which, to be clear, you know, Trump didn't get a majority of the vote, and young people have not much love for Trump. And so I think the transition that we're in the middle of is bumpy. One reason to think that there may be a large constituency in the future for a peaceful, free, multi-ethnic democracy is, in fact, in the social unrest, is a call for enough of the state violence, right? It's not a call for, you know, crush the ethnic minorities. And so I have some confidence that we're moving in the right direction in terms of building this kind of prosperous, peaceful, multi-ethnic society, but there's still a lot of inequality and a lot of state violence against, in particular, Black and Latino people. And so you know, the point is, in that transition, things are really bumpy. And I think we're in the transition now. But I also have some optimism that we're moving towards a period where the ethno-nationalist contingent no longer has a winning national coalition.
Yeah, you came into my view, or I first learned about you through both my predecessor at Reason, Virginia Pastrell, but through your website, Black Planet. You were part, you always struck me as, and you were on places like MSNBC, if I'm not mistaken, but You were kind of an avatar of a techno-utopian or techno-optimist moment, where one thing that was kind of fantastic about the late 90s, and I realize part of this is just old manism on my part, but that we had gotten to a point where we could be more individualized in every aspect of our lives, you know, in our commercial lives, and, you know, how we could order things, how we could monogram things, but also on our identities. I mean, on the most, the most meaningful expressions of ourselves, that we were no longer just seeing each other in terms of black and white or male or female or East Coast, West Coast, whatever. Everything became much more nuanced and complicated in a good way. Did that, you know, like, I mean, that isn't how we're talking anymore. We're talking in the most kind of brute terms of ethnic identity or tribal, tribalism, whether it's racial, ethnic, or political. Is there any way back to that earlier kind of glimpse of a different future that was not scornful of identity, but rather, you know, it was like, let's, instead of being one of two things, let's be one of 10 or, you know, 10 or 20 things?
Yeah. So I think Virginia Postrel once said to me that nature abhors a void as it relates to politics. And so she was always skeptical of the kind of more anarchist schools of thought, because to her mind, into that void was going to come some, more probably authoritarian power. And we might think about something similar with identity, where people have a deep need to feel kind of rooted in community. And in a sense of, you know, peoplehood. And that doesn't mean, it's not mutually exclusive with what you said about I can be, black and into anime and, somebody who likes to, ride a motorcycle.
Right.
But I think there's just a profoundly human need for connection. And those connections often have a kind of, They're rooted in history of groups that we kind of ascribe meaning to.
Right.
And I say all of that to say that, like, you come to California, where I am right now, and I remember talking to a friend of mine who teaches at a high school here, and we were, the school was 90% Latino. And so in a school that's 90% Latino, there are Latino goths and Latino skate punks and Latino, rockers. And it's like, that heterogeneity is there, but it's not uncoupled from them also feeling very rooted in, Mexican American community in LA or something, right? And so I think it's possible for both to exist, but it's also requires something like California, where some of those cleavages aren't the organizing cleavages by which kind of power operates, right? And right now, if you're, if you feel like you're being over policed as an African American, then it's sort of your side hobbies aren't going to be the thing you mobilize around. And conversely, if you're, a white evangelical Christian who says, I am angry about, transgender bathrooms and same-sex marriage and the, Me Too and Black Lives Matter, you feel like your, values are under assault. And it becomes important to you to kind of mobilize with the people who share those values to try and assert, your power. And so I think we're in a bit of a shakeout where those axes really matter in terms of who has power and how laws get made, but they also might fade to agree with time. I think the slightly more concerning version of it is research that suggests we're moving into a world where essentially party becomes the overarching identity.
Yeah.
And that might mean that, in fact, going back to Virginia's idea about, nature abhors a void. I mean, clearly not her phrase, but when I was talking to her, that it may be that there isn't actually a kind of more atomic state for humans, that we're always going to be tending towards an agglomeration, and that, quirky editors who have a rebellious streak. You're in the what I think of like my father, the Groucho Marx club. Like, you would not join any club that would have you as a member.
The idea that the limit of my identity is going to be either Republican or Democratic. That's very depressing. So, and I hate to end on that note, but Omar Wasso, I want to, we'll leave it here. Thanks so much. Princeton University political scientist. You can find contact information in the text field for this interview. Omar, thank you so much for talking.
Thank you, Nick. Really appreciate it.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at reason.com/podcasts, Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.